Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good Tuesday morning. I hope you all had a wonderful Labor Day. Amy Jacobson here, Dan here. Dan Proft is here, I should say. He has the luxury of going from Florida today. I don't know if he can hear me or not, but he mentioned about the violent weekend once again in Chicago. Dan, can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you. And so, you know, the difference this weekend, of course, was that you had so many young people that were shot, one murdered. And so this prompted Chicago Police Superintendent David Brown to offer a specific address to kids being gunned down in the streets of Chicago. Do we have that clip?
We do, and it's unbelievable. Because
stay away from children if you want to live that life. You're harming this community. You're harming these families. And we will be relentless in pursuing you.
And this is basically an updated version of Tiny Dancer's Take It to the Alley. Remember that classic?
Oh, yes.
That's what you heard there from Superintendent Brown. So you had Lori Lightfoot then, Triple Threat, was out in the community, you know, monitoring the situation, and she had this to say.
The people in the neighborhoods are doing the shooting. They are known to people in the neighborhoods. And I understand the fear that's out there. You've got to have your faith overcome your fear. You've got to step up.
I mean, so a four-year-old boy was getting his hair braided by his father at 9 o'clock at night. You know, it wasn't 3 in the morning, and bullets flew through, shot him twice in the head. 20 rounds were fired. And if that's not bad enough, then a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old, Dan, were shot while they were in a jumpy house on a Saturday afternoon. There was go-karts, cotton candy. Here's the 15-year-old girl's father. Luckily, she and her 12-year-old friend survived.
We touch people's lives and just give them something positive, even if it was just for momentarily. And I don't know what's in these people's heart that would make them want to shoot at a bouncy house, at go-karts, at cotton candy.
This is customary. And frankly, what is there to say about this? Rather than to address exactly what Brown and Lightfoot said, oh, you're serious about getting after people who are victimizing these kids. Really?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36, type in DA, then a quick comment. I listened to the whole press conference. And he's urging us, Dan, you know how we could protect our children? Asking those who might, you know, be targeted to stay away from the children, but also take it a step further. Don't have them over to your house.
I love some members of my family, but they're not coming to my house for Christmas because of the life they lead. And I make that very clear.
Is that an appropriate way to address violence in the city?
David Brown can do whatever he wants. Here's the bottom line. He said that, and she said that they're going to get after people. That's where this all starts and ends at this point, in the immediacy, because there's only so much you can do to address the endemic cultural problems in these neighborhoods and in America generally. In real time, you have to take predators off the street. So let's talk about that. Tribune story over the weekend. About Chicago police and Cook County prosecutors in a dispute over whether to bring murder charges in the shooting that killed 7-year-old Serenity Broughton and wounded her 6-year-old sister. That's the Tribune story. The Tribune story didn't have a lot of details that I got from a friend of mine who's a higher up in the Chicago Police Department. So let me just summarize this. So we're talking about kids. They have this big presser about kids. Lori Lightfoot does her Potemkin walk in the South Side to make the same point.
So I mean, it was a photo op. She walked 2 blocks.
So what are we doing? So here's what you had. You had the Serenity Broughton. You had a 7-year-old who was murdered on Grand. The suspect was brought into Area 5. Lineups ID'd him at the scene. A relative gave statements implicating the suspect. The suspect's car was identified on scene. The suspect's phone was established to be on scene. The suspect turns himself in. He implicates himself on video before he lawyers up. The state, meaning Kim Fox, refuses to charge.
Why?
Chicago Police Commander Eric Winstrom goes around the state's attorney's office and gets a judge to issue an order charging the suspect. Then Fox calls Superintendent Brown, saying the move by Commander Winstrom, who, by the way, is also an attorney, will embarrass her office. So then Superintendent Brown has his chief of detectives get another judge to rescind the first judge's order charging the suspect. Then the suspect in the murder of this 7-year-old girl, Serenity Broughton, is released without being charged. That's a story that belies all of the bloviations you heard over the weekend from Superintendent Brown, from Lightfoot, from this entire political ruling class. This is the Chicago way in the identitarian era, in the Fox triple threat era. That's what's going on.
But the fact that he implemented himself, I mean, he even told police before he lawyered up that he had something, he played a role in that.
There was a more than enough evidence to charge. And it's the same story as the Orland Park special ed teacher that was killed, murdered on the Dan Ryan. And they have the two suspects in, and then they release them, and they say, well, they were defending them. The report is that the top line is they were defending themselves because somebody was shooting at them. And so it was an inadvertent shot that went through the taillight and killed that Orland Park teacher.
Yeah, it's called involuntary manslaughter, which is what they should have been charged with.
It may be. But here's the bottom line. Kim Fox has asked no questions. There is no follow-up on any of these details. I've got all these details. I haven't seen anybody yet. So the Tribune reported on the, oh, there's this back and forth. That's not good enough. This is the beginning of the reporting. So Kim Fox and Lightfoot and Brown, tell us about this case. Tell us about the Serenity Broughton case. Tell us about that Orland Park teacher's case. Give us the details. You walk us through the evidence you had, the decisions that were made, the basis for those decisions. You lay it bare for the public. That's one thing that could be done in the short term, even in absence of trying to address these longer term issues about, you know, the cycle of violence in some of these neighborhoods. But I'm right now, the police and the prosecutors, and obviously by extension the mayor's office, that is where answers could be demanded, and they're not being demanded.
And it's not only that case. I don't know if you remember the 19-year-old Illinois National Guard soldier who was shot on the 4th of July weekend. They have videotape evidence of a high-ranking Milwaukee Kings gang member. And the Kim Fox refused because that's not definitive enough to press charges. And the family is demanding on her to file murder charges. And they actually held a press conference saying that this is the evidence we have. We know he did it. He knows he did it. And she let him go. Time and time again, she's doing this and no one's holding her accountable. 312-642-5600, turnkey DePro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Jordan and Forest Park here in Chicago's morning.
You know, I think the Tribune ought to put together an Excel spreadsheet. Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically, there's about 4,000 shootings a year in Chicago. So over the last 5 years, you got 20,000 line items on this Excel spreadsheet. And ask the police department, ask Lori Lightfoot, ask Kim Fox, where do all these things stand? Has anybody been prosecuted? Has anybody been arrested? Because basically, there's too many of these things going on. There's no way they're going to be able to control this without major changes.
Well, thanks for the call, Jordan. That's
great
a fair
idea.
That's a fair point, but I don't want to get into aggregate stats. I want in real time when you have people's attention focused on this, you give me the specifics. I don't want to see spreadsheets. I want to see all of the details. I want to hear from the participating individuals. Take the gag order off Commander Winstrom, Superintendent Brown, and bring him forward to give us the details in the case as he understood them, why he made the decision that he made, which I think was the proper one, to go around the state's attorney's office and get a judge to issue the charging order himself, why, how it happened that Brown sent his chief of detectives over to another judge to rescind the first order judge. Everybody should be in a sort of public press conference style setting, town hall style setting, and they should explain the decision making in these specific cases, because I think they provide real insight into the culture in the halls of power and law enforcement in Chicago and Cook County in a way that stats do not. That's what needs to happen. Craig in Mount Greenwood, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for taking the call. Listen, these people in these neighborhoods, they know exactly what's going on. They're not going to turn any of these thugs in or anything like that, because they know exactly what you've been talking about and explaining. The cops come out there, they arrest them, they do all their hard work and bring them in there, and that Lightfoot and Fox and them, they turn around and just put them right back out on the street. These people are evil, rotten people, and they want Lightfoot and Fox, they want this to go on. They love doing this with the criminals, letting them off the hook and everything, creating all this here so that they can just come up with gun laws and everything for law-abiding citizens. That's it.
Thanks for the call, Chris.
I mean, why do they want to empty out the prisons? I don't understand. I don't know what the end game is here.
Well, first of all, I mean, the important point that Craig made, so you hear the, you know, yeah, your faith has to overcome your fear flim-flam from Triple Threat over the weekend. And Craig's exactly right. You think that they don't see that the people they know are committing violent crimes are right back in their neighborhoods? You think that they don't know about multiple felons who get a pass or on electronic monitoring and so on and so forth? And so what kind of trust should law-abiding people in those neighborhoods that are beset by violence, what kind of trust should they have in Lightfoot or Fox or Brown? If I was there, I would say none. Why am I going to be party to the way that you try to stop violent crime, so you say, in the city of Chicago, when I'm seeing what's happening, when I'm and you know, by the way, just because you're poor or you're in a bad community doesn't mean, you know, you don't read what CWB Chicago, you don't read the Tribune, you don't know what's going on. In point of fact, I bet the law-abiding know precisely what's going on. They know what's going on much better than any politician, much better than any radio talk show host. And so maybe there's a reason that has less to do with their courage and more to do with the understandable loss of faith in the institutions that are charged with providing for their safety. Maybe that's the story. And I'm happy to talk about the neighbors. I'm happy to talk. We've talked a lot about it. We'll talk more about culture, as you know. But the institutions and the people in charge of them, this sort of like general bitching about them, their performative press conferences, and as you said, photo ops in the neighborhood once every few hundred shootings, there has to be an accounting. There has to be a unified call for them to make a public accounting with specifics on these specific cases that are completely inexplicable. The Orland Park teacher and the 7-year-old Serenity Broughton case, to me, seem to be perfect examples. Marvin in Burlington.
I'm just curious, Dan, how one judge could look at the evidence from the commander and say, yes, issue an arrest warrant. And then they go to another judge because we don't want Kim Fox embarrassed. And the other judge says, okay, rescind this order. How can he not see what the other judge sees? Is the laws that ambiguous that they can't determine? I don't understand.
No,
that.
That's a great question. That's a great question. Thanks for the call, Marvin. And I suspect we'll find the answer is, well, when Superintendent Brown sends his chief of detectives to a judge that he has a relationship with, that judge is going to do whatever the chief of detectives wants. Right. So that's probably what's happening. But, you know, we shouldn't have to surmise. We should be able to ask that question. And that, by the way, that judge should be at this fictional town hall press conference that I'm talking about. Both judges, the judge who gave the order that was requested by Commander Winstrom and then the judge that rescinded that order.
And Commander Winstrom should be elevated to a higher position in the police department because of what he did.
Yeah,
I mean, he's trying to put criminals behind bars. I know, instead of him being celebrated, of course, you know, who knows what's going to happen to him. It was Superintendent Brown in charge. Who knows?
And Winstrom, I understand, is like as straight an arrow as there is in CPD, but he's also not from here. And so perhaps he was just a little confused. He doesn't understand that we don't prosecute criminals here if their identitarian intersectional score is high enough. That's the Kim Fox triple threat ideology at play. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So we've got a recall election coming up in California, and I just love the Hollywood celebrities that are now weighing in, trashing Larry Elder. You know, he's the blackface of white supremacy.
Right,
I don't know if
exactly.
You've heard.
Grew up with a silver spoon in his mouth, right, Dan?
Right. Like Crenshaw High School in South Central.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Real aristocrat. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But Gavin Newsom's going to lecture him on what it means to be black in the inner city. Of course. Sure. It makes perfect sense. It's California.
It's laughable. All right. Well, what are they doing to our friend now?
Well, the best celebrity tweet I saw, you know, trashing Larry Elder and the whole recall notion, and then, of course, folding in the Texas abortion
yes.
matter. This guy, Ron Perlman, who looks like a primate.
Stop. All right, now I'm going to have to Google him. All right, Ron.
Sons of Anarchy.
Oh, that's right. Okay, yes.
And the problem with Perlman is he thinks he's, rather than just being an actor, he thinks he's that motorcycle club, essentially gang leader in Sons of Anarchy. He's a big tough guy who goes on social media and swears about Republicans all the time. So listen to this riff, just to remind you of the sort of intellectual level of these wonderful actors that we enjoy.
Hey, what's up?
What's up?
You live in California? You hear about this bullshit that's going on right now?
He's a tough guy.
Yeah. Republicans want to just recall a governor. Do what they always fucking do. Just grab the power so they can turn back the clock to like the good old days, 1600s, 1700s. You know, just like fucking ISIS, right?
Just like ISIS.
No voting rights.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Anybody who wants to get vaccinated or wear a fucking mask. Or maybe have a life so they can go back to work, go back to school, go back to the f***ing movies, maybe watch a f***ing concert. They just want to roll all that shit back. Not because they can win, because they can't. So they're just going to f***ing steal it.
Yeah. Just point of order, Mr. Perlman.
Yes.
The recall law is a law. It's a provision that was duly passed in California. By the way, if you didn't like it, you could have had your Democrat, socialist-controlled General Assembly, state legislature, as well as your governor, change the law. But they chose not to do that. I mean, that's just the sort of baseline. This is what you're dealing with. This is what Larry Elder can look forward to when he's governor, hopefully, cross my fingers, September 14th.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. This mother of all snafus, the American withdrawal from Afghanistan, continues. It's not clear. Well, I should say one thing is clear. Americans are not getting out. It's not clear who the responsible parties are. Maybe there's more than one. Maybe it's our government and the Taliban. Representative Mike McCaul, who's the ranking member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, was on with Chris Wallace over the weekend. And he had this to say, describing some Americans who had boarded planes to get out and are not being let out by the Taliban.
And in fact, we have 6 airplanes at Mazar-e Sharif Airport, 6 airplanes with American citizens on them as I speak, also with these interpreters. And the Taliban is holding them hostage for demands right now. The state has cleared these flights, and the Taliban will not let them leave the airport. So I'm sorry, the answer to your question is zero. And that's my concern, is they're going to demand more and more, whether it be cash or legitimacy, as the government of Afghanistan.
Let me pick up on this, because I didn't know this. You're saying that there are Americans on airplanes ready to fly out of Afghanistan right now, and they're not being allowed out because Taliban is making demands. What demands are the Taliban making?
Well, they are not clearing the airplanes to depart. They've sat at the airport for the last couple of days, these planes, and they're not allowed to leave. We know the reason why is because the Taliban wants something in exchange. This is really, Chris, turning into a hostage situation where they're not going to allow American citizens to leave until they get full recognition from the United States of America.
Now, how does he know so much more than President Biden and Blinken,
well,
our Secretary of State?
I don't know that he knows more. I think he's just perhaps more forthright about what all of those parties know. But here's the thing. There's also a report, Fox News reporting, that it's the State Department that is delaying the departure of private evacuation efforts. Rick Clay, who runs the private rescue group Plan B, telling Fox News the State Department is the only thing preventing the flights he's organizing from leaving Afghanistan. Two other American individuals separately involved in evacuation efforts, whom Fox News is not naming to avoid jeopardizing those efforts, similarly said the State Department is the sole entity preventing their charter flights from leaving Afghanistan. So Mike McCaul, House Foreign Affairs Committee, is saying Taliban is preventing flights from leaving with Americans on them. These private rescue efforts are saying it's our State Department that is preventing their charter flights from leaving and bringing Americans home.
Well, one plane was available. Well, did get out. Four Americans were flown out by Corey Mills and a private team of military veterans. And then the State Department attempted to take credit for that. Like celebrating over the, we're not all on vacation. No, we're working hard. Four Americans got out from Afghanistan.
Right. I saw that. Corey Mills, friend of the show. We've talked to him before.
Yeah.
But our government, you have three different individuals, three different private rescue efforts saying our government is not giving the clear to leave and come back. I mean, could that possibly be true? That seems to me, on both sides, both what McCaul is saying about the Taliban as well as what these rescue efforts are saying about the State Department, that needs to be fleshed out today with Jen Psaki, I would say. Could you imagine if that's true? Could you imagine if our State Department is thwarting the efforts of private rescue initiatives?
But really, does it surprise anyone? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Well, you leave Americans behind. You say 10%, what you say 10% of those who still want to get out but are stranded there, dare I say stranded there. That's a rounding error now in this era of American history under this president, 10% of the total population of Americans in Afghanistan. That's a rounding error. Now you're potentially, if this Fox News report is right, if these multiple individuals associated with rescue efforts are accurate, you have the State Department preventing their successful evacuations because why? Because they don't want to be embarrassed? So now you're going to put American lives at risk. You're going to essentially potentially create hostage situations or put American lives further at risk or worse because you want to cover your backside? Is that what's going on? That seems to be a question that needs some exploration. Again, individual stories. We said just because the Biden administration wants to move on doesn't mean we should, and we're not going to.
Well, they want COVID. Let's distract. Change people's narrative.
25-year-old Nasria, pregnant 25-year-old, just got married. She's an American. She's a California resident. She is stranded in Afghanistan with her husband, and the Voice of America had her story largely in her own words.
There's been days where, you know, I think to myself, like, am I going to make it home? Am I going to end up living here? Am I going to end up dying here? What's going to happen?
25-year-old California native Nasria came to the Afghan capital in June to visit family and marry her longtime boyfriend. She and her new husband fled to the airport after the Taliban took control, but they never made it in.
It was so hard to just get on a flight. There was a couple days where we had to sleep on streets. People were literally stepping over people. That's how bad it was.
After her booked flight home was canceled amid the chaos, she reached out to the State Department for help.
They told us, go to a certain location, you will be picked up. And this is from the State Department. You will get picked up. Go there. And it was in the middle of the road across the airport. So we went there, waited an extra 12 to 13 hours with no food, no water, nothing.
She'd wave her passport.
They won't let us go. They're gassing us at their food.
But day and night, the Taliban kept blocking her.
I got gun pointed to my head. Our troops were literally at the gate, just waiting for us to continue walking. And they had blocked us. And there was a time where, like, I went past them and I started walking as fast as I can. And they started shooting right by my leg and told me to come back or they would shoot me.
Oh, my God.
That's how it was. And I've never in my life have ever been experienced anything like this. It was like a movie scene. It was like literally a movie scene.
She says her husband, an Afghan national, even begged the Taliban to let her in the airport without him. But she refused to leave him.
I was not going to leave without my husband because I knew in my heart I was never going to, you know, step a foot back in Afghanistan once I go home. And I'm pregnant, and definitely my child is going to need a father. I'm going to need a husband by my side. I don't even think I'm going to be able to go home. I definitely lost some hope. If I was only 15 steps away from the airport, and I was told people are going to come out of the airport to get me, so what hope am I supposed to have now?
What hope is she supposed to have now? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Oh, don't worry, Nasria. Ron Klain, Joe Biden's chief of staff, he's on it. They're going to figure out ways.
We believe it's around 100. We're in touch with all of them who we've identified on a regular basis. Obviously, we're hopeful that in the coming days, the Qataris will be able to resume air service out of Kabul. And if they do, we're obviously going to look to see if Americans can be part of those flights. We are going to find ways to get them, the ones that want to leave, to get them out of Afghanistan.
We believe we're going to try. Those buzzwords aren't giving me any confidence.
We're going to find ways.
We're going to find ways.
That sounds like somebody without a plan. I don't think Nasria has heard from Ron Klain and his people recently. She doesn't sound too hopeful, did she?
No, and if a reporter can contact her, then they can contact her, too, and get her out of there. But they're choosing not to. Why would you leave Americans behind?
She's a rounding error, Nasria. Rounding error. Sorry, Nasria. Bob and Waukegan.
Yeah, they're all lying sacks of Durban. Glenn Beck tried to get 500 Christian Afghans out of Afghanistan like a week ago. I saw him on the news. He was interviewed. Don't remember who interviewed him, but the State Department was blocking. He had 500 people on a plane, and the State Department was blocking him from coming into any lily pad area that they had. They would not allow him to land in any of those. And also, there was another Special Forces guy on Fox News last week, and he had 50 Americans and interpreters in safe houses. And he was trying to get him out, and the State Department wouldn't let him. So it's true.
Thanks for the call, Bob. By the way, Daryl Issa, Congressman from California, he puts the number at 500 Americans, not 100 to 200, closer to 100, as we've been hearing for the last week from Team Biden. Frank and Joliet.
Yeah, two quick points. You know, they're going to spin it that woman chose to stay because she wouldn't leave without her husband. Another thing, too, you know, if they really want to find these people, just put them on the Democrat voter list and they'll get their mail-in ballots. They'll find them.
Thanks for the call, Frank. And by the way, you know, she said that her husband tried to say, let her in the airport and leave without me. She didn't say that they offered her that. She just said that's what her husband tried to do. I'm sure they did not. These are the same people that were shooting at her feet saying, get back. Mary Ellen in Crete.
Hi, you guys.
Hi.
I think the reason they're holding these planes is because when they come into the United States, they will have the ability to go on Fox or your show or some other shows, Dan Bongino. And the State Department doesn't want that that media information. You know, they don't want to fight.
Well, they're
that.
Already getting their stories out. I mean, even from Afghanistan, where they're stranded or soon to be being held hostage.
Yeah, Voice of America, you know, the Nasria story right there. I mean, we talked about this in the beginning. The idea that you can just walk away and leave Americans behind, leave Afghan allies behind, and everybody's just going to, you know, I don't hear anything, I don't see anything. That's not going to happen. And all it takes is these stories to get out, which are getting out, to continue to undermine and place the Biden administration in a position as an object of ridicule and shame, an understanding the American people have that this is a heartless, in addition to incompetent, administration. And that's what's coming across. And there's nothing they can do to stop that. So you can have some people that are Biden loyalists try to run interference for him, as you're having some in the media do and Biden voters do, and just, you know, turn their eye away from the unpleasantness. But that's not going to work for the majority of Americans, as we're seeing as his numbers are plummeting. Candace in Mount Pleasant.
Morning, guys. Mary Ellen and the previous caller, I'm sorry, the gentleman, I didn't get his name, but I did watch his episodes of The Blaze, you guys, and it was amazing. He was so frustrated. Because, and I came to the same conclusion as Mary Ellen, they don't want the truth coming out, and they are willing to leave it. But the other point is about that is, Dan, this kind of reminds me of what happened to Laura Logan. Remember during the Arab Spring and how she was, what happened to her? And
she was raped. She was sexually assaulted.
I know, but a lot of the left didn't want to go near that. And 60 Minutes strongly advised her not to talk about it, and we're kind of trying to brush it under the rug. It's kind of it's a weird, similar situation. They don't, they think that it reflects on leadership, and of course it does. And I think this all reflects on Obama, because let's face it, what does Biden know what's going on? He knows nothing that's going on. It's just a goof.
Thanks for the call, Candace. By the way, our new friends, the Taliban, and their incoming regime of tolerance and worldliness.
Equity for women, yeah.
Taliban militants shot and killed a pregnant police officer in front of her children and husband, the BBC reports. Then they've identified her name. Killed in front of family members outside her family home in Firozka is the name of the city. And, of course, Taliban denying responsibility for that murder. But that's...
Because I don't think women should be police officers. They shouldn't go to school, shouldn't drive, shouldn't shop.
So this is, you know, the spin you've heard for the last several weeks, and now we're witnessing the reality on the ground. And as I said, yes, there's people running interference for Biden best they can, but it's not going to be good enough. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and Dr. Ashish Jha is the dean of Brown University's School of Public Health. He was on with Chris Wallace over the weekend, and this is just an amazing exchange. Most notably because of what Chris Wallace had to say.
Chris Wallace
has just learned that there are some questions about the efficacy of cloth masks. This is yesterday or Sunday, and he wanted to run that by Dr. Jha.
several reports this week that cloth masks, which frankly are the kinds of masks I usually wear, are not really effective. Is that true?
Yeah, cloth masks unto themselves, generally not effective. That's why I think surgical masks are better. There are, of course, higher quality masks. Cloth masks may be 10 or 20% effective, not great against the Delta variant.
So you're saying this mask I've been wearing for a year isn't really protecting me very much?
I'm saying that given the Delta variant that's out there, you probably need to upgrade your mask, Chris.
What? Who, me?
Well, thank you for that, and I think a lot of people thank you.
All that money spent on all those masks.
Isn't that a stunning exchange? Chris Wallace hosts Fox News Sunday. And because I assume it's because finally some left outlets that we mentioned last week, Vox.com, The Atlantic, New York Magazine, started to address the science of mask wearing. Now, all of a sudden, it makes its way to Chris Wallace's show for him to, 18 months in, ask that question of a public health professional like Dr. John.
Shame on it. But the shock on his face, what, me? What, this isn't working? What? It's, I mean, so people are so brainwashed, especially in the mainstream media, that they don't even bother to even read other research that's out there. My doctor told me, Danny, he said, listen, the surgical mask, too, that you're wearing, the coronavirus, it could still get through. All you're doing when you wear that, all you're doing is protecting people if you sneeze or if you cough. So that's why I am choosing not to wear a mask where you know, in public, I should say, when going to the bank or the grocery store. I protect them. I'm not going to sneeze or cough. Okay? That's my way of contributing.
Well, the news still hasn't gotten to everybody, even though it finally got to Chris Wallace. A Glenbard North music teacher named Scott Grigoletto had this exchange with a kid in the hallway of Glenbard North because the kid lowered his mask.
You're playing? Are you playing? No, I'm not. Oh. Otherwise, I will call the police. Oh. I'm serious.
I hear my...
Yeah, can I...
Oh, are you serious?
Yeah, I am serious, man. I am had enough of it. I knew you were going to take off your mask the moment I turned the corner. So enjoy BIA. What's that? That's in school suspension where you have to sit in the room with the military guy all day because you're a piece of
Jack at the corner.
And he called him a piece of you-know-what.
Mm-hmm.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Where can we start? If that was my son's teacher, I would demand him being fired today, not, you know, on a leave of absence while they investigate. You don't need to investigate. You saw that. And by the way, the teacher's mask was under his nose. He wasn't wearing it properly. And no one else was in the hallway. So what if the kid wanted to take down his mask to have a breath break, they call it. That's what the kids are calling it now. So that's his right. This guy has lost. He's a percussions teacher at Glenbard North, and his LinkedIn profile was just, you know, taken down, so I don't know what that means.
It means he doesn't want to get hammered by people who have seen this video. That's
too late for that. This thing has gone viral, as it should have. Parents need to see what's going on in public schools and their government-run schools.
Well, Scott Grigoletto is hardly alone. You have these social media postings from the most hysterical of the hysterical in the teaching profession that have punctuated these debates for the last 18 months. One that went viral just a month ago, a Texas teacher, listened to her talking about COVID and the heightened anxiety she has and her colleagues have going back to teach in person. Now, again, apparently all of the science and data is unknown to her, like it was unknown to Chris Wallace about masks until 48 hours ago. But this is what you're dealing with, and this is why you get such unhinged conduct from, you know, dum-dums like Scott Grigoletto, who should stick to banging on a drum.
I have had my regular back-to-school anxieties, things like, am I going to have enough time? Am I going to get my lessons done? Are the students going to be okay? But this year, there is this overshadowing apprehension that's clouding my normal back to school thoughts. And it's with thoughts like, if I die,
oh my God,
who's going to take care of my children? And if I end up in the hospital, how am I going to pay those bills? And if I give COVID to my students or my own children and they die, how am I going to live with that? And I want you to ask any teacher how they feel this year. And I'm sure that they will tell you that they have never experienced anxiety like this, because it is like we are trying to protect our students from a mass shooting that we know is coming, but cannot do anything about. Except we can do something about it. It's just that not everyone agrees that wearing a mask will stop the onslaught of students and staff who are likely to become sick. And that makes me sick.
I mean, this sounds like a woman who's, she'd be lost without something to be afraid of, doesn't she? I mean, I'm sorry to tell her, honey, you're going to die of something. But the good news is you have a 99.999 chance of surviving COVID. So their chances of dying from something else are pretty good.
It's interesting that she compares COVID to a mass shooting, because it's similarly rare in terms of taking lives. On Friday, the CDC published a morbidity and mortality weekly report that breaks down COVID data from August of last year to August of this year. There were 1,790 hospitalizations of patients below the age of 18 that were counted in this from this database of medical care centers. 1,790 patients below the age of 18 hospitalized in 140 care centers that were sampled around the country. Remember, there's 75 million people in this country under the age of 18. The median length of stay ranged from 2 to 3 days for the entire year-long period. The mortality rate for the children hospitalized, a total of 8 COVID-19-related deaths among the 1,790 minors that were hospitalized over the last year, against the backdrop of 75 million kids in this country under the age of 18.
That proves that the mortality rate for the seasonal flu is higher than COVID. Okay, go on.
The survival rate was 99.9997. And yet you have this, I need to make my last will and testament in order to teach, you know, my fifth graders kind of business from this teacher. You have this silly music teacher at Glenbard North, this phony adult.
Wait, it's
running
a power.
Around screeching at kids and, you know, whatever, and using profanity to boot.
Shame on him. I mean, that's disgusting. I'm around kids. I would never in a million years, no right-minded teacher would ever call a student that. And he thought he could get away with it. And now the woman whose son recorded it, she's saying on Twitter this morning that her son is being reprimanded and punished for taking the video and sharing it. So there, now it's her son's fault, not the teacher's fault, who said it and who was wearing the mask improperly too, by the way, and who has a little anger issue there, maybe a little Napoleon, problem because he's a shorter dude, but he should be reprimanded, not the kid who took the video.
Yeah, okay. They're your schools. Glenbard North is the school that you wanted to make it. Western suburbs, Glenbard West, all the Glenbards, all the government schools, most of the private schools. They're the schools that you've chosen to tolerate. So your kid gets called a piece of excrement by some music teacher. Yeah. What do they say? Well, what are you going to do about it? Mike and Hammond, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer. Mary Kay in Western Springs, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, you guys. I had a nice long conversation last night with some neighbors about the vaccine. And what it came down to is they told me because I'm not vaccinated, I'm part of the problem. You know, I'm the one who's causing us not to be able to get back to normal. So I had to explain to them, you know, why I took my position, what I feel about it. You know, I mean, You guys, we all know the information, the vaccine, not long tested. I've had some health problems. I don't want to do it, and it's my right not to do it. And I am not part of the problem because I stay 6 feet away from people. I throw a mask on when I'm around elderly people because I just want to be respectful, and I don't want them, you know, to get upset or walk away, you know, walk far away from me. And so if Chris Wallace doesn't even know this basic information and nobody knows about the vaccine, where the hell are we at? And that teacher who was talking about that young teacher, my family might die, what will I do if I die? They've been saying this for a year and a half. Things have changed in a year and a half. We have got, there's a lot more information out there about what's going on. How would she pay her bills if she went into the hospital? Well, gosh darn it, how would you pay your bills if you had a baby who was in the NICU? How would you pay your bills if your kid got a horrible disease? These people make zero sense, and I'm tired of it. And you know what I'm doing, Dan? I'm talking to these people, and I'm busy and work all the time, but when I run into people, I'm defending my position. And thank you for, you know, hammering away at this. At least we're all listening, and hopefully, persuading some of our circles of influence, as you say.
Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. And let's remember again the lack of any evidentiary support for transmission from kids to teachers in schools. Also, a study that has been forgotten, we mention it occasionally here, a Yale University study of some 40,000 daycare centers that found no incidence of zero. Of child to adult transmission. And so what do I get? What do you get when you say these things? You get this sort of silliness from phony adults. All of those kids don't have grandmothers either to give it to.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one, yeah.
So for those, when somebody says something so ignorant like that, oh, the grandma and grandpa, killing grandma and grandpa, this is just like a refrigerator magnet for the COVIDian. When somebody says that, then what is your prescription? The transmission occurs in the home, but you don't want kids in school. Transmission primarily, what we know from the science, the studies, transmission primarily occurs in the home. So what is your public policy prescription for 330 million Americans? So you have a one-size-fits-all answer to that? Or do you say, well, here's what we know. We know the older are more vulnerable. And we know that kids are not vectors of transmission. But to be on the safe side, yeah, maybe you don't have kids around grandma and grandpa for a period of time if grandma and grandpa are particularly compromised, or if grandma and grandpa say, I'm feeling particularly compromised. A lot of grandmas and grandpas will say, I don't give a rat's behind.
And
I want to see my grandkids. And I've had 80 years on this earth, and there's a lot of us. Yeah, it's much more lethal for my age demographic, but there's an overwhelming percentage of us who, by the way, survive too. You act like that the evidence is 60 plus, it's a death sentence rather than a 94%+ survival rate because people are ignorant and self-righteous. And it's a terrible combination to be both ignorant and self-righteous. If you're going to be self-righteous, at least be correct. At least have the facts. But they don't.
And this whole thing with Miami-Dade, 15 teachers dead in the past 10 days from COVID. Who? There's one that we know of for sure. And all who are the other 14?
It doesn't even matter. The question is, what do you suggest we do? What about this and what about that? What is your prescription? What is the public policy we should impose? That's what I want to know. Don't give me this, what about grandma and grandpa? Like you care about everybody's grandma and grandpa more than I care about everybody's grandpa and grandpa. It's so juvenile. It's such cheap sentimentality. I'm so sick of listening to it, and I'm sick of watching other people indulge it. Don't. Jeff in Cal City.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. For that blubbering teacher that you had on just a bit ago, you should play for her the theme show of MASH, and hopefully she'll get it.
All right, Jeff. Tim in Woodstock.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Amy, thanks for taking my call. But, you know, during the pandemic, I had the privilege of serving as an interim chaplain I'm not even, let's say, qualified, but I was very involved with the nursing home during Bible studies over the years. They were having trouble finding a chaplain during that time, and I did it. And I watched people die alone with no one around them, try to talk to their families later. And I'm telling you, virtually anyone that I talked to and got close enough to ask them, they did not want their grandchildren or their children being prevented from coming to them because of some chance that they might get COVID. I mean, it just drove me crazy. I eventually had to resign over the vaccine that I refused to get. But and I was sorry to leave some of them behind. But anyway, I went to two board meetings here in Woodstock, guys. And, you know, some 30 people got up, myself included. 2 weeks in a row I spoke. Some 30 people talked and presented statistic after statistic about the mask. And there was one doctor on the board, others who have doctorates. And you just got the feeling and you knew that this was the first time they'd ever heard any of these statistics. They were like, later in the night, they're like, well, we've been presented with a lot of statistics tonight to think about. And it was just unbelievable. There's something out there called a mass psychosis.
Yeah.
You can get that on the Academy of Ideas. But Dan, can I just ask you real quick? This week they're going to start testing in the schools on the support staff. And I want to stand on the Illinois Healthcare Conscience Act of Illinois. And is that the way to go, you know, in your opinion, just to stand up against the testing? I'm not getting the vaccine. I'm against the mask. But now the testing's coming at us this week.
Yeah, I mean, thanks for the call, Tim. I think that's your best option. I mean, under the law at present, it's your best place to litigate if you don't otherwise have a medical reason to not get the vaccine, you know, that's substantiated by a doctor, then the Healthcare Conscience Act in Illinois it's something that should be litigated. That's for sure, and you should get some adjudication of cases like that, so we see exactly how that law is going to be interpreted. Right now, it's a bit gooey in terms of our understanding of where the courts are going to be on it.
Right, and this whole you have to have hand in your vaccination card still, to who and to what? I mean, do companies really have a plan in place? Because larger places like CPS, there's still no plan in place. There's no plan in place for students.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
I mean, I think this. You said this beginning, press release politics. I'm really beginning to believe that, Dan.
Yeah,
that was just a suggestion. You guys have this date to be vaccinated by.
However, yes, it is press release politics. They launch and then they figure out how to impose, but. But don't be skeptical that they'll figure out how to impose.
That's right. Yep.
Margo in Burr Ridge.
Yeah, as you know, as a District 41 taxpayer, now I'm talking about that Hunyak last week that thinks she's a third grade teacher, and as a Glenbard North taxpayer, because we have commercial property there, I've got to say I really would like to know who is hiring these miscreants that don't even understand what appropriate professional behavior is. It's not a matter with this third grade teacher that you discussed last week. It's not a matter of whether gay or straight. Sex is not appropriate in third grade. They will figure it out. For millennia, people have figured it out in their teens, and they will figure out whether they're gay or straight. They don't need any help from her, and they certainly don't need to have this pushed on them at such a tender age. It's just wholly inappropriate. And his saying that word to that student, of course we've all said it. We all have heard it. But it's not professional. Who is hiring these people? We have got to find out.
Thanks for the call, Margo. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. One of the more underreported stories last week in terms of reaction from the cultural centers in the West, in America specifically. The Chinese government's crackdown on the tech and entertainment sectors. They don't want any more, I'm using their phrases,
right.
Sissy idols, effeminate men. And also they want to guard against any sort of media or entertainment that is, quote, overly entertaining, unquote.
Yeah, you can only play your video games for 3 hours on the weekends only for kids.
They want more emphasis on traditional Chinese culture, revolution culture, and socialist culture. They also will, according to the apparatchiks there at the National Radio and Television Administration, yeah, they have such a thing, they will establish a correct beauty standard and also boycott, mean censor, ban vulgar internet celebrities. So our elites in finance and Hollywood and government, no comment on this? Entertainment, no comment? LeBron James, would you care to comment? What does that say about China's trajectory? The Chinese communists, we have to be clear all the time because, of course, people want to misinterpret this as something that's race-oriented rather than ideology-oriented. The Chinese communists, the communists in charge of the country of China, that's who we're talking about, and the totalitarian system they're imposing and the genocide they're committing, that's who we're talking about. What does that say, the reaction or lack thereof, continuing, the wringing of the hands for cameras, but little else with respect to understanding and maybe reevaluating our relationship and providing leadership in the world to reevaluate their relationships with the Chinese communists, or at this point, is that ship left the port? Well, let's talk it through with our next guest. He is Desmond Shum. He's born in Shanghai, raised in Hong Kong. He developed the largest air cargo logistics facility in China, the Beijing Airport Cargo Terminal. He also led the development of the Bulgari Hotel in Beijing. And he's got a new book out called Red Roulette, an insider story of wealth, power, corruption, and vengeance in today's China. The only way he develops those projects that he develops is with interaction with the Chinese communists. We know that, so he should have great insight. Desmond Shum, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. The first thing I have to say, I'm very happy to talk to you guys in Chicago because I went to Wisconsin-Madison. Mm-hmm. I used to be in Chicago all the time.
Yeah, but you left like everybody else is leaving Chicago.
And Chicago's not how you left it. We can guarantee that.
All right, we won't hold the UW-Madison education against you. But before we even get to that dynamic, the business endeavors that you were successful in, I assume, some sort of coordination or interaction with the Chinese government. The disappearance of your ex-wife, this is a chilling story, and so I just want to get right to that, and the re-emergence of your ex-wife upon the publication of this book.
Yes, she actually, almost to the day, she was disappeared by the state on September 5th, 2017. I'm coming out with the book, actually just launching today. And then the news about my upcoming book came out, the two big stories on FT, Financial Times, and Wall Street Journal last Friday. And miraculously, she appeared on Saturday. She reappeared Saturday, may I say.
Well, so did she reach out? Did she call you? How did that happen?
Yeah, I think she came out on Saturday, sometime on Saturday, and then it was middle of night. I have moved over to United Kingdom. I'm living in the UK now. And it's middle of night here, so she called my mom and my cousin, and so they sent me a message. When I got up in the morning, I saw the message. I was just, dropped to the floor. It's just like, really? Wow, is this really happening?
What do we understand? What do you understand about her disappearance and reemergence? Where was she?
She wouldn't say. I'm sure her phone is being listening. Her line went dead for 4 years. I don't assume they give you the phone next day and say, well, you can call anybody in the world, right?
Right.
So I think she's being very cautious on, you know, she knows her. She's being listening to everything she say. And also she said, well, she said there's several things she said. First of all, she said she signed a paper of temporary release. So she's not official release. And she said they can take her back anytime.
And the they is the Chinese government. And why?
Yeah.
Why was she disappeared? Why is she in their custody?
They actually, over the last 4 years, they never even acknowledged they have taken her. So it was a lot of guesstimate on our side. And then on the call this time, I asked her, what's her charge? And she said, her reply was, it needs to be kept confidential. She cannot disclose what her charge is.
Wow. And you have a son together, correct?
Yeah, we have a son. He's 12 now. You know, he talked to his mom for the first time in the last 4 years.
Last 4 years.
And I mean, and so give us the backdrop of how something like this could happen, or and maybe does happen routinely, particularly since you and my understanding from the reading is your ex-wife, you were successful business people there. You had to be to some extent in with the in crowd. So how does that go awry?
First of all, I mean, in China, the way the things works, and that's one of the things I want to review in the book, is anybody, you know, if you're running any type of business, if you are running a corner shop, selling newspapers and Pepsi Cokes, you need to be in bed with some political power, maybe a police car on the beat in your, you know, on your street. Just in our case, we went up, reached, you know, we were in partnership with the wife of the then premier of China.
Okay. And so yeah, like you said, you have to be involved with the authorities at any level. Okay, but you were involved with the authorities, the Chinese communists, at the highest level. And so how do you fall out of favor, or your ex-wife, or both of you?
It actually, what happened is, how should I put it? First of all, why she is taken for 4 years, I don't know. I mean, it's all guesstimate. But I'm guessing that's with the change of political wing in Beijing. I think a lot of we all seen, you know, on a global stage, how the politics of China has changed and how the behavior of China has changed in the last under this regime of Xi Jinping. And then I assume she is associated with the wrong crowd and maybe heard the wrong, you know, get wing of the wrong, some high level politics that she shouldn't be known of, and she become a nuisance and got disappeared.
And does she want your book to be published and to come out today, or is she trying to stop that?
Actually, I think one of the reason they let her out on temporary release is get her to call me and stop the book.
Mm-hmm.
So. Right. Because I don't know who I'm talking to in a call, because she could be just, you know, listening to a happy earpiece and then being a sounding board of the official bureaucrats at the back, right? I mean, and then not, even if that is not the case, we all know she's being listening on her calls. She's giving certain tasks she need to do, and then so she was basically threatening me, you know, delivering a message. Basically, she raised the question, "What happened to our son if something happened to you?"
Hmm.
She said, "Right, what happened to you? How would you feel if something happened to our son?" At one stage, she even said, "You know, you go on with this project; it's going to cost a life."
Oh. And the truth is most likely just the opposite, because thugs like these like to beat people up in back alleys, not in the public view. And what you're doing by publishing this book is bringing them out into public view and giving this case notoriety it previously didn't have.
Yes, I believe the world knows too little about China. The world knows too little about the party state that controls China. I mean, I think it's very important. I mean, I started this book years ago, this book project years ago. But if you look at the events of the last 2 years of this pandemic, I think it's even more important for people to have an understanding of what we are dealing with here, this party state.
Well, give us a summary.
I mean, this pandemic, yes.
And the pandemic is a good backdrop, you're right, but I mean, so is the concentration camps with the Uyghurs and so many other examples. So give us a sense of what we're dealing with, what we don't understand about what we're dealing with.
I think we don't understand, essentially, it is a mafia state.
Yeah.
At the top is a group of people who are descendants of the quote-unquote founding fathers of today's China. And they are the back is ruling over this country. And this is by bloodline. It's almost the aristocrat of the medieval time. Their sons are now in power. You know, Xi Jinping obviously is a second generation. His father was one of the top 10 generals of in the 40s. And their sons are in power. The grandsons are in power. They intermarry among themselves, and they will always be there. And entrepreneurs, whether it's my ex-wife, whether it's us, or whether people like Jack Ma, we are pawns in the game. We are all sacrificable.
Right. That's important. Even Jack Ma, Alibaba, you know, the multi-billionaire, nobody has enough money to be insulated from their vagaries.
They in China, many anecdotes of my story would tell you, money counts for nothing. It's all about political power. You know, in the eyes of the political power, Jack Ma counts for very little. Their view is, hey, I can wipe you out tomorrow, and I will pop up another Peter Lee, Jack Lee, whoever. I can recreate the richest person tomorrow. And that's no such a thing called private property protection. The state look at everything in the state, every account, bank account in the state, whoever, whether the company own it or the private individual own it, is the property of the state. A person like my ex can disappear for 4 years. We've never been charged.
And so do you think that American politicians have an appreciation for just exactly what the intrinsic nature of the Chinese Communist Party is? And if not, what should we be doing in terms of how we engage, how we deal with China that we're not doing? What should we, you know, what sort of position should we take? What's the weakness of the system other than its internal contradictions domestically?
I think the first thing important is to raise awareness of what are we dealing with here. What is China and what's their intention? I think one of the very important thing to realize is the Communist Party and the elites of the Communist Party know that their power, their hold on power is illegitimate. They never run re-election in the 70 years they're there. And so they're paranoid. And because of their paranoia, they want to wipe out all possible threats to their hold on power. So that's why the internet is blocked, misinformation is rampant in that country, and all news outlets controlled by the states. And because this paranoia, they want to even control the dissenting voices, anything they perceive as possibly with threat, be a threat to their hold on power, even in foreign countries. That's why, you know, when Australia come out and say, well, we need to know the origin of the pandemic, they immediately start a trade war with Australia. And then this desire to permanently hold on to a power they themselves sees as illegitimate will eventually bring them to the states that, well, until I have the whole world under my thumb, I will not feel secure. It's this intense sense of insecurity push them to say, I need to conquer the world in whatever form they may succeed. So
So if you were advising, American policymakers, how would you suggest that they confront China? And that includes, by the way, corporate America, too, who they seem to be doing a nice job of compromising through basically payoffs.
I think, if just looking the case of my ex, without charge can be a person can be without charge, disappear and throw into a bad jail, bread cell for 4 years. And she herself told me the day before. She never have, in over the 4 years, she have no news of the outside world. Does anybody want to live in that world like that? And that's where the world will be if China has the rule of the world. So I think U.S. politicians need to realize and understand you are dealing a sworn enemy. You may not be sworn in to oppose them, but they are a sworn enemy of yours by their choosing. And once you realize that, I think today the Biden administration is talking about, okay, we can cooperate on certain things. We can, we're going to stand our ground on certain areas. And then we're going to try to work together on certain areas. It's not going to happen. You can try, just like look at the last Kerry trip to the, on climate change last week. Anything come out of it?
No.
What's that word? They basically say, okay, climate change is a bargaining chip.
Yeah, right.
Right. They say you want to work me to work with you on climate change. We need to change so other terms of all our relationship.
Is there any difference between Putin and Xi? I mean, are these both guys that, talk in the lexicon of revolution, but are really, as you talked about mafia state, are really just kleptocrats at their heart?
I think there is quite a bit of difference. I think the way they hold on to power, the Communist Party is a party state. I think, to my understanding, it's limited. Russian and Putin's hold on power is in a different form. And also, obviously, I mean, China now is, 7-8 times the size of Russia economy. And then they have rich around, across the world and continue to grow and come out. So we're dealing with a very, very different animal here.
If you were the CEO of an American company, would you do business in China?
That is, I have friends who are in those positions. That is a very tough decision because the capital market in the U.S. is very short term. If I'm a CEO today, my question is, I'm going to turn out the quarter report. I go set a factory in China. I know they're going to be stealing my technology. I know that will be creating competitors. But that will be, that will be a real threat to the existence of my company 5 years down the road. And I will have made my paychecks, my bonuses over those 5 years. But if I don't go to China and my competitor went, my growth will be, let's say, 20% slower than my competitor. And how I'm going to explain it to the board, and am I going to get my next bonus? So it's this short-termism which is built into the capital market in the U.S. So I think in this kind of situation, it's very hard for unless the government step in, it's, you know, the capital market, just the way it works, the capital market does. It's very hard to stop the American company to sort of cozy up to the Communist Party if they see a profit opportunity.
He is Desmond Shum. He's born in Shanghai, raised in Hong Kong, developed the largest air cargo logistics facility in China, the Beijing Airport Cargo Terminal. He also led the development of the Bulgari Hotel in Beijing. The book, Red Roulette, an insider story of wealth, power, corruption, and vengeance in today's China, understanding who we're dealing with the Chinese communists, which just releases today. Pick it up. Red Roulette is the book. Desmond Shum is the author. Mr. Shum, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for
you. Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Mike Manapkin runs the Democratic House floor for 30 plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. Gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when you're moving out.
Dan and Amy, good morning. That's theme music, which follows him around wherever he goes, means it's time for our weekly conversation with Ted Dabrowski, president at WirePoints, wirepoints.org, wirepoints.com, gets you to the same site, all things Illinois policy related. People have been, just as the song said, moving out over the last decade. Wirepoints.com documented it over the weekend. Ted, thanks for joining us, as always. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
So the last decade, change in population, Illinois versus our Midwest neighbors, how'd we do?
Yeah, well, we're one of three states to lose population over the decade. West Virginia, Mississippi, and include there Illinois, right? So we lost 18,000 people, which is a big deal because that means that we wiped out all the people who were born. You know, we always have a net births minus deaths. We always have a positive there. And we always have foreign immigrants coming in. And we wiped out all those and more in lost population where, you know, places like Florida and Texas, you know, grew by 2.5 to 4 million people. So it's just a massive difference of you know, growth and tax base and energy and production and, you know, investment.
Well, yeah, and the order of magnitude is the key. 18,000 people, if people hear that number, they say, well, 18,000 people in a state of 12 or 13 million people, that's no big deal. But it is a big deal when you talk about Texas or Florida in the millions of gain. And also, even our neighbors, Indiana, we lost 18,000 in the last decade. Indiana gained 300,000.
300,000,
wow.
Yeah. That's huge. That's huge. Now, you're talking about, you know, in our case, well, in their case, they're adding, a Rockford and whatever you want to pick, a Naperville, right? They're adding two big cities to their population. And think about that. What that means is you've got a tax base that's growing. You've got more investment. You've got consumption. So it's a vibrancy that every state needs and wants, right? And if you're a job creator, well, you're going to move there as well because that's where people are. If you are, you know, provider of goods, well, you're going to move there because that's where people are buying stuff. And when you look at Illinois, you're going to say, I got to think about that one. And that's exactly what Warren Buffett said a few years ago. He says, I'm not putting my production there because they're going to come after me to pay all those pension debts back, and I'll never make money. I'll be stuck there 30 years.
Yeah. How do you think COVID has exacerbated the exodus from Illinois?
You know, it's really complex, right? Because it's hard to think about how things are moving. You know, we definitely saw big moves to the suburbs. We've seen apparently Cook County grew, and that was a surprise for people. Overall, 87 out of the 102 counties in Illinois shrank. But COVID adds a whole new element to it. In fear, you're going to have a whole bunch of people who are ticked off that they're being shut out from their work, that they're being, you know, in many cases closed out from schools for a while, or are being forced under the diktats of Governor Pritzker. They may get ticked off, and they also realize that they can go work in Colorado and earn money in Illinois, or Florida for that matter. I don't think it bodes well at all for Illinois, but it's hard to predict. I think it's one of those things that are hard to predict in the short term.
There's also, you know, some subtext to these numbers of in-migration, out-migration. that are important. So like, for example, the median household income of people moving in versus the median household income of people moving out. And I know a couple of years ago, Illinois had the highest spread in the nation in the wrong direction, meaning it was about a $20,000 difference in the median household income of people moving in versus those moving out. So then, you know, that also speaks to a diminished productive capacity.
Oh, it's fascinating. That's one of the, I shouldn't say it's a surprise in the numbers, right? But you're right, you know, the gap, and I'm trying to find our data here, but it's about, you know, $20,000, the difference between somebody who leaves Illinois and somebody who comes in. So we're importing people with less means, right? That means a smaller tax base, and we're losing people with more means, and often that means they're more productive, they hire people, they have businesses, and so we're draining our best, you know, on average, and we're getting back people who are, you know, less productive, and that's going to cost us over time, and that ignores the net loss we had of people, right? You know, when you look at the actual out-migration numbers of people leaving Illinois, not births and deaths and not immigration, foreign immigration, but just people leaving from one state to the other, we're the second worst in the country, just behind New York. So we're losing people. And we looked at every demographic. We've looked at every age group, every income group, and we're a net loser in every single one of them.
I got a way we can make it up, and the Chicago City Council is way ahead of me.
What?
We bump up the salaries of politicians like Chicago aldermen who are scheduled to see a 5.5% increase in their salaries. Ooh. To $130,000, which is more than double the median household income in Chicago.
Well, that's a good way to do it. You know, you're bringing up an important story that I think we've kind of picked up over the last week, and that's you know, while all this stuff is happening, right, COVID, CRT, all the crime, Afghan, all the things that have been going on, there's something else going on all the time, and that's you know, the bills for the average Illinoisan keep going up, and we're seeing school contracts being renegotiated with, you know, big raises and big everything, big benefits. We're seeing other places trying to issue pension obligation bonds so they can hide the pension problem. You know, it's the property taxes and pension debts are going up. So as we're ignoring all those things in the meantime, they're going to get worse, and the fiscal cliff is going to be bigger, and the bill is going to be higher, including things like salaries for our politicians.
Explain why pension obligation bonds to fund pension payments is lose-lose.
Well, it's you know, what some cities are doing, and we just saw Moline, East Moline, and Rock Island. They'd like to do that. You know, it's so cheap to borrow right now that cities are saying, hey, we can go borrow all that money that we owe to our pension debts, right? You know, 30, 40, 50, 100 million, all these cities are in deep, deep debt. And they just want to borrow it, stick it in the pension funds, and effectively it's a net gamble. The cities are hoping to borrow cheap and then to take that money invested in Wall Street, and these politicians think that they can do better than the borrowing cost. And if they make money, they're going to say, hey, we did well, and they're going to pump that money into the pension fund. But if they do poorly and they lose money in the markets, guess who's going to have to pay the bill? The taxpayers. So it's really letting politicians gamble with taxpayer money, and you know, heads I win, tails you lose kind of thing.
Is there any town in Illinois that has a surplus, a budget surplus?
Forget that. I mean, you know, there's a few cities like Naperville, which are younger, you know, younger cities that have grown a lot. And so I don't think anybody's got a surplus because everybody's hiding all these pension debts. So when you put these pension debts back in, it's all ugly for everybody. It's just a question of whether it's really ugly or just ugly.
Speaking of pensions, just sticking on this topic, I don't know who really cares about this
cares,
anymore, but I'm going to continue to raise the issue as you continue to work the issue just for our own enjoyment. As I've used this example before, like guys, the musicians on the Titanic playing their instruments as the Titanic sunk, doing it for their own enjoyment. So that's the same thing here. The recent report on the Chicago Police Pension Fund, some of our listeners' ears may perk up on that. Not good news, and it's not just about the dire funding level of 22%. There are other problems.
Well, this is the problem with all the stuff that happens in Illinois, right? And you know, you tie in the corruption to it. So, you know, you take pensions, you're talking about billions of money, billions of dollars that are being managed by let's say bureaucrats and overseen by politicians, right? You know, what can go wrong? And what we're seeing is that there's all kinds of games being played between money being moved. There's a pretty dire report out by a group that from pensioners who wanted to challenge, and they want an audit of the pension funds. And you know, they want a different view than the official political view, and it just found a lot of scathing things about the games that are played there. And you know, I think they need to be proven, but a lot of allegations of mismanagement, a lot of game playing, as we know, and of course how dire the funding is. Hey, but Dan, important point about pensions. Pensions are boring; people's eyes glaze over. But I think when we're talking about all the bad things that Illinois is doing, the reason we're bringing it up is because, you know, when the next property tax bills start coming and the next income tax hike discussions start, this will be why. Pensions will be one of the big reasons why. So people should be aware of that.
Well, right. I mean, we have tried to beat this drum as loudly and as often as we can. But, you know, in Illinois, you don't own your home. It's collateral for somebody else's pension. And the value is just whittled away. Your equity is whittled away because of the confiscatory property tax rates. And then even in this little bump from city to suburbs, which won't last, you can't win. You can't get a return on investment. You can't even maintain the home's value long term. And, you know, that's people, when they go to sell, all of a sudden realize, wow, what I thought I was going to have, what I thought my home was worth, what I thought it would set me up to do when I want to retire or want to do something else. It's just not the value isn't going to be there. So the money's not going to be there.
Well, yeah, you can already see that problem when you travel around the Peorias. And, you know, I've talked about that. When you just drive around those neighborhoods, you'll see the housing stock doesn't look good. It doesn't look healthy. And, you know, it hasn't moved over here to the wealthy suburbs of Chicago. But at some point, those people who've been supporting a lot of these failed policies will say, hey, what happened? You know, what happened to my home values? Why can't I sell? Why? And, you know, at some point, the math always kicks in. It's just not there yet. And certainly not with the, you know, multi-billion-dollar bailouts we've gotten from the federal government. But, you know, when that money runs dry, you know, I don't know, is it 2 years from now, 3 years from now, it's going to be, uh-oh. You know, what happened, and why didn't somebody fix all this? We'll be finally talking about it, but not now. Maybe a few years from now.
And of course, this largely goes to fund K-12 school systems. So how are we doing? I'm so glad you asked. The National Assessment of Educational Progress, for the past 20 years, achievement broken down by school district level, of the 27 U.S. urban school districts that reported their results for 2019 from Boston and Chicago to Fort Worth and Los Angeles, not a single one of these 27 large urban school districts, not a single one can say a majority of the black eighth grade students in their care are proficient in either reading or math. And some of the numbers are just stunning, although you shouldn't be stunned anymore. Detroit, 4% proficiency for math, black eighth graders, 5% for reading. Milwaukee, 5% for math, 7% for reading. Chicago, New York, in the teens.
Yeah, you know, what it is what's sad about it is we continue to defend the current model. And actually, we're tweaking the current model now. So, you know, we're adding all the equity elements and all that. And you know, none of those speak to merit. None of those speak to, you know, just to becoming, how do you want to say it, competent in things. It's we're, you know, I just saw a new higher ed study that's being done. It's all the same thing: more equity, you know, get rid of merit, get rid of competence. And when you look at those results that you mentioned, it's really sad. It's sad, but I guess it's beyond sad now. Nobody seems to care. But at some point, again, it's a system that has to break down. I don't think you could design a system that does worse than what it does. You couldn't purposely design a system that does what it does. Right, you couldn't. How do you design a system that gets 5% proficiency in reading? You can't.
Right, and then what's happening in the selective enrollment schools for the, you know, the small percentage of students that get to go to those schools, like in Chicago? One parent of a child at Peyton, she described it this: it's like the new Jacobins, except instead of knitting needles, Madame Defarge moderates Instagram accounts. Which is a great Dickens reference, by the way. But more to the point, the selective enrollment schools, those kids aren't really necessarily getting that much of a better education. They just have a better education at home.
Right. And, you know, then you get back to the whole family impact and all that. I think really what this is, and, you know, I think we're talking just about COVID and that this is what's going to happen here. We're hoping, right, that this whole mess opens up the eyes to people of what has to happen, such a new generation of learning and a new generation of how to learn. And, you know, it's maybe still a pipe dream, but when you see these results and you see the funding problems we're going to have and the pension problems, and you look at the pensions that the teachers are making, you know, in many places and superintendents, you just say the whole system is broken, it's corrupt, but, you know, until I don't know, until it breaks, we continue to do the same thing.
We were just talking to a Chinese dissident business person who called the Chinese communists a mafia state. I think that has application outside of Beijing. He is Ted Dabrowski. He's the president of Wirepoints, wirepoints.org, for all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks as always.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and the Moo variant. Yes, the Moo variant.
Moo.
Not an immediate threat, says Dr. Tony Fauci, but he's keeping an eye on it to make sure it doesn't become more dominant.
Oh, well, please. He's just trying to remain relevant. But yeah, do go on.
Well, how is he going to keep an eye on it to make sure it doesn't become more dominant? How are you going to stop it from becoming more dominant?
I am so sick of it. He was just on CNN about 2 hours ago. Say he was very upset watching all the people at football games who are outdoors unmasked in large settings. Like, come on, just stop already. He's so annoying.
The Mu variant has been identified in Colombia, the country of Colombia, as well as 36 other countries. And so I think at minimum, it bears some theme music. We have to have fun with these variants since they're never going to stop. And
right.
We're never going to stop reacting the same way we've reacted to the Delta variant, I suspect. So
yeah, I like the Delta.
So hit it, Lamar.
Clap your hands, everybody. And everybody clap your hands. We lambda, and Omega Moon. And we've come here on stage tonight to do a show for you. We got a rockin' rhythm and a high-tech sound that'll make you move your body down to the ground. We got Poindexter on the violin, and Lewis and Gilbert will be joining in. We got Booger Presley on the mean guitar, and a rap by little old me, Lamar.
Yeah, how about you think? I mean, that covers the Omega and the Lambda variants, and those are our Omega and Lambda busters, just like we have the Rona busters, generally speaking, here in Chicago.
Wait, what happened to the Epsilon? Remember the Epsilon? That was the next one in their back pocket, but it pittered out.
Well, I don't have
it
theme music for that.
Oh, that's I'm just saying before there was the Lambda, there was the thought of the Epsilon, but it didn't take.
By the way,
which is a good thing.
On the actual medicine, science, virology side of this. Mm-hmm. Dr. Ashish Jha, who is the dean of the School of Public Health at Brown University, he tweeted out, worried about the Mu variant? Maybe Lambda? I sure am. How about C.1.2? That sounds scary. Don't. While we are still learning, doubt they'll displace Delta and our vaccine should hold up fine. I don't lose sleep over new variants. I worry about people's fatigue with the current one. Yeah, I mean, I quibble with some of what he has to say, but generally speaking, at least his feet are firmly planted on terra firma as opposed to, I don't know, you know, the teachers at your kid's school, or at least some of them, and the politicians that you elected, or at least some of them. So you know, some context for what you're going to hear now is as variant Moo stories for the rest of this week to see if it's something that they can run with. And if it's not, they'll drop it and they'll wait for the next thing they can run with.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. But the fear-mongering from politicians isn't going to stop until we make it stop collectively, until we stop caring. because that's the only way out of this craziness. Because Governor Pritzker, I mean, he loves to sell fear and bull jive and makes these declarative statements without any science or data behind them.
Something else, too, on the therapeutic side, I want to make sure we get to this story. When they're not whipping fear without foundation, they're suborning perjurious testimony. Oklahoma.
Unbelievable.
Oklahoma doctor named Jason McKellier. Told horror stories about hospitals jammed with patients who self-medicated with ivermectin. You know, this was...
And the horse dewormer. Right?
Yeah, it was picked up by Rolling Stone. Of course, I'm glad they learned their lesson from the fake Virginia University of Virginia rape case.
Vice-ice.
Self-medicated. This was patients self-medicated with ivermectin are filling up the ERs. So backed up that gunshot victims were having hard times getting into facilities where they can get definitive care and be treated. That's what Dr. Jason McKellier said.
And they attached with it a picture of people standing outside in the cold. And folks, it's September. And those people were in line for testing, by the way. That was an old file footage. And by the way, that Dr. Jason, he doesn't even work at that hospital. He's not even in the ER.
Northeastern Hospital System in Sequoia, Oklahoma, issuing the statement. Although he's not an employee of NHS Sequoia, he is affiliated with a medical staffing group that provides coverage for emergency room. With that said, Dr. McKellier, hasn't worked at our location in over 2 months. They went on to say to the Substance, NHS Sequoia has not treated any patients due to complications related to taking ivermectin. This includes not treating any patients for ivermectin overdose. All patients who have visited our emergency room have received medical attention as appropriate, has not turned away any patient seeking emergency care and so forth. So it was a completely manufactured thing that, of course, the media, it fits what the media wants to be true. So they run with it unsubstantiated.
Well, shame on them. I mean, they need to come out with something because gunshot victims, how many people are getting shot in Oklahoma? I mean, I know people get shot everywhere, but it's not rampant either that they're turning away gunshot victims. It looks like it's from The Onion if you read the headline.
The more important aspect of the story is therapeutics and this continued blacklisting of therapeutics from conversation. This has been going on for months despite some many promising studies, not to mention real-world results for people who've taken ivermectin. The same thing with monoclonal antibodies like the Regeneron mobile stations that Ron DeSantis has set up in Florida. So you've got Regeneron, the monoclonal antibodies. You've got ivermectin. We've talked about it here in recent weeks, some promising studies for fluvoxamine as well. And it's just not part of any conversation. This is from December of last year, so December of 2020. Mm-hmm. Dr. Pierre Corey, who's a physician at Aurora St. Luke's Medical Center in Milwaukee, talking about ivermectin. This is in testimony he provided before the Senate Homeland Security Committee, again, December of last year.
In the last 9 months, in our review of all of the literature, as a group, again, we are some of the most highly published physicians in our specialty and the world. We have done nothing but try to figure out how to identify a repurposed and available drug to treat this illness. We have now come to the conclusion after 9 months, and I have to point out, I am severely troubled by the fact that the NIH, the FDA, and the CDC, I do not know of any task force that was assigned or compiled to review repurposed drugs in an attempt to treat this disease. Everything has been about novel and or expensive pharmaceutically engineered drugs, things like tocilizumab and remdesivir and monoclonal antibodies and vaccines. We have 100 years of medicine development. We know we are expert in all the medicines we use, and I do not know of a task force that has been focused on repurposed drugs. I will tell you that my group and our organization, I will say that we have filled that void. That is all we have done is focus on the things we know and things we do. And I'm here to tell you, Dr. Ryder, he just presented. He has one study of the many that I want to talk about. And I want to talk about that we have a solution to this crisis. There is a drug that is proving to be of miraculous impact. And when I say miracle, I do not use that term lightly. And I don't want to be sensationalized when I say that. That is a scientific recommendation based on mountains of data that has emerged in the last 3 months. When I am told, and I just had to hear this in the opening sentence, that we are touting things that are not FDA or NIH recommended, let me be clear. The NIH, their recommendation on ivermectin, which is to not use it outside of controlled trials, is from August 27th. We are now in December. This is 3 to 4 months later. Mountains of data have emerged from many centers and countries around the world showing the miraculous effectiveness of ivermectin. It basically obliterates transmission of this virus. If you take it, you will not get sick.
And so you still have people having to sue on behalf of their relatives to get that therapeutic when they're hospitalized.
Yeah, our friends, I mean, they try to get to, they're being held hostage, Dan, is what they are. And I know a patient in Amita, we had a very good family friend, they were trying to get hydroxychloroquine to their loved one because they were trying anything, and they said no. So then they went to court to file an injunction to get them out, and her brother died because it was too late. And that is so sad. So you give up control of your loved one when they enter the hospital. You can't get them out.
I just don't understand the ideological opposition to therapeutics that show promise. And as we've talked to actual emergency room physicians, show results in specific real world cases. I just don't understand why that can't be part of the conversation. I don't understand in an era of right to try, if you remember from the Trump administration, try experimental drugs, even that was overwhelmingly supported across party lines, but you don't have the right to try something that does have science behind it, that is a otherwise FDA-approved product, and it just needs approval for alternate use, as we've talked about before with ivermectin and other potential therapeutics. I just don't understand people that are ideologically opposed to it. I mean, if ivermectin works, it works. It's not like it's like a pro or anti ivermectin. Like it's like I'm a fan of ivermectin, or I'm not. Like it's a sports team, or like it's two political candidates. If it works, it works, and if it doesn't, it doesn't. What does the research say? What is the real world experience? And why can't you just go on that basis and have a conversation about it? But if you bring up these therapeutics, it's like you're anti-vax, or you're misdirecting people away from the conversation we need to be having, which is just wear your mask and get your shot.
But another thing that's really got my goat is this, you know, the Rolling Stone wrote a completely false, 100% made up story about ivermectin. Yes, words are hard today. And Twitter didn't label any of the stories or the shares as false. Not one. Because it got a lot of thousands, tens of thousands of likes from, you know, the left wing sheep, and they didn't flag it at all. It is a completely fabricated story.
And I just go again, this is the 74-year-old COVID patient who died down in Texas, prescribed ivermectin, admitted before he was able to take it. And then this hospital in Sugarland, Texas would not administer it. So there was a court battle to get the hospital to administer it or allow a doctor to come and administer it. We had a similar thing in Elmer's Hospital. And he died. The family won. They got a court order. But it was too late. He died waiting for that order to be effected, to be utilized, and the therapeutic to be utilized. It's just, I don't know. The strident opposition to these things, the lack of interest in exploring the possible utility of some of these therapeutics, it's bizarre to me. And I think it calls into question those who are so strident. Suzanne in Mount Prospect, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi. I saw Dr. Robert Malone on an Epoch Times American Thought Leaders interview. I think it was
his September 4th interview. And he does touch on, I believe, on the therapeutics. But one thing that I thought was particularly interesting was that he mentioned, you know, the sense of giving a vaccine in the middle of a pandemic, because the vaccine will allow the most virulent strains of the virus to survive because the vaccine is 100% effective. He was saying that, you know, it might make sense for people who are have, you know, comorbidities or particularly old, but he had indicated that it really doesn't make sense to give it to an entire population.
Oh, yeah, thanks for the call, Suzanne. And there's some disputes about what Dr. Malone has said about vaccines creating, you know, stronger strains of the virus. But regardless, so fine. So have people with expertise in the arena openly debate the matters. What's wrong with that? Everybody has to agree. Everybody has to say the same thing. Nobody's allowed to suggest anything else because we've decided what the truth is, and that's the end of the conversation. You know, like how science works, where we've decided what the result is and nobody should ever research or discuss or think about this again. Well, of course, that's the opposite of how science works and progress is made. It's so silly. A friend texted too, the same way they won't talk about natural immunity.
Right.
And the impact of those with natural immunity on the overall, you know, sense or proximity to herd immunity we have. It's just the vaccinated. It's never the numbers of those who were infected and recovered are not included. And I don't know what the reason is, but as I said, if somebody wants to deny something that is true or something that certainly is a legitimate topic of debate, that you cannot talk about it, we will not debate it, that is not part of what we accept for the purposes of our policy recommendations and instruction to the public, then I think you should be highly skeptical of people like that. Jerry in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call again. I saw something on TV today, this morning, of hurricane coverage or, you know, tropical depression out there in New York and New Jersey, and they showed a picture of a guy walking his bike in knee-deep water during torrential rain wearing a mask. And I thought how ridiculous it is, and I think that's what's going on. I think what's going on here is that if the government can't get you to take a vaccine to wear a mask, how are they going to take your guns? And I think that it's control. It's all about control.
Thanks for the call, Jerry. Vince in Crystal Lake.
Dr. Bright at the FDA blocked hydroxychloroquine. He should lose his medical license. He's no longer at the FDA. He stepped down, but he blocked hydroxychloroquine and other therapeutics. And he should lose his medical license.
Thanks, Vince. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I know this is not a revelation, but it's a continuing frustration. These news talk show hosts that don't read anything, that don't know anything.
Yeah. But haven't lived, have no street smarts either.
Chris Wallace this weekend was just a study in dutifully not paying attention to any debates raging below the surface of the Beltway press corps.
He has just been going along to get along for this entire 18 months.
I don't know how somebody like him gets tapped to moderate a presidential debate or have a show for that matter. And of course, he's not alone. They're almost all this way. But in addition to just now learning about some science studies that suggests that masks, particularly cloth masks, are not effective, he also allowed this statement from FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell to go unchallenged.
And we're also seeing, as this storm and some of the other weather events that we've seen, they're just intensifying very rapidly and dropping a large amount of rain and tornadoes. This is the crisis of our generation, these impacts that we're seeing from climate change. And we have to act now to try to protect against the future risks that we're going to face.
I don't know how you're able to slide in a statement like that on a news talk program and the moderator doesn't challenge that. In fact, and this is from Bjorn Lomborg at the Copenhagen Consensus Center, and Bjorn Lomborg has addressed this. Michael Schellenberger has addressed this. Holman Jenkins has addressed this. Many people have addressed this. Our next guest, too. In fact, per Bjorn Lomborg's piece in the Journal, looking at the data, the frequency of hurricanes making landfall in the continental United States has declined slightly since 1900. And the hurricanes are not more powerful either. The frequency of Category 3 and above hurricanes making landfall since 1900 is also trending slightly down. In addition to that, the impact of hurricanes in terms of damage is trending down and is projected to trend down. Why? Because we have better engineered infrastructure.
Right.
But other than that, what Deanne Criswell said was right on the money. You can't have any sort of proper policymaking when you don't hold people in positions of authority to account for things they say that are untrue. I mean, how much time have we spent on COVID making this point? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by our friend from National Review. He is David Harsanyi. He is a senior writer there. He's also the author of the book First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun from the Revolution to Today. David, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, on these matters, and it's more just a general commentary with this climate change business, you know, against the backdrop of COVID and the backdrop of everything being about safety and public health. And once you invoke those magic words, there's nothing you can't do in America today in terms of restricting people's liberty. You know, just your reaction to that and the quality of the discourse as it continues to in my estimation, deteriorate.
Well, yeah, I mean, safetyism has always been the excuse in some form of, you know, authoritarianism, and that's the case today in America, and that's been the case always. And you know, the idea that, you know, you mentioned the climate change comment the FEMA person made, but you know, deaths from climate events and death from climate itself has just plummeted over the last 100 years, but over the last 50 years. And as we saw in Louisiana and elsewhere, when hurricanes now hit, there's far less damage than there used to be because of the because we're ready for it and because the infrastructure, as you mentioned, has gotten better. So to just drop a statement like that shows that there's really no critical thinking going on when it comes to this sort of, you know, science, quote unquote, stuff that it's treated like it has, you know, treated like a religion. And it's not. I mean, there are debates ongoing on masks and on climate change and everything else that I think a lot of people in the media and probably now in government ignore.
But a lot of people fear that, you know, we have these COVID lockdowns, that we're going to have climate change lockdowns. Do you see that happening?
Yeah, I mean, the way they wanted to, for the CDC to unilaterally just simply invoke, you know, to tear up contracts between renters and landlords retroactively, and just to decide how long this eviction moratorium could go on. And I mean, why? You know, because there's an emergency of COVID, even though obviously it's I think far less dangerous now than it was before, because we know what to do to protect ourselves from it better. Why wouldn't they do that with climate change? In fact, I think I've seen stories where, you know, there are a lot of people, a lot of politicians advocating for having emergency powers when it comes to climate change. So, of course.
You wrote a book about America's enduring history with the gun. So Second Amendment rights, self-protection. And a lot of people see this safetyism as also including a gambit to restrict people's rights to protect themselves. And I mean, you have had Rochelle Walensky at CDC say that gun violence is a public health problem. She's not the first one to say it, but it's worth noting that she's saying it in the current context. Is it illegitimate for people to be worried about a safetyist gambit to restrict gun rights the same way that they have made with viruses, the same way that they may make with climate change?
No, I mean, thank you for mentioning that. I mean, they make the same exact arguments when it comes to gun criminality, but gun deaths and suicide as well. Even though, again, over the last 30 years, I mean, until very recently, gun deaths have been going down, despite the fact that many, many more people have bought firearms. But they don't care. You know, they just simply say there's a gun, you know, violence epidemic. And frankly, some cities, as you know well, there is. But it has nothing to do with legal. That's the only thing they can restrict. So that's what they'll go after. So, yes, I mean, safetyism for sure. You know, it starts, you know, I wrote a book years ago called Nanny State, and it just starts with the little things. And then we sort of normalize and acclimate to being told what we can and can't do. And then it gets bigger and bigger. And I think now, you know, we're at a point where they want to, you know, where property rights don't matter, where the Second Amendment doesn't matter, where the First Amendment doesn't matter. And that's just a dangerous time.
Right. I mean, you don't need to pay your rent per your comments on the eviction moratorium, and you don't need to work either. And because you can't, the ABC News over the weekend, the headline on the expiration, the story of the expiration of the enhanced unemployment benefits that has now visited us, people set to lose enhanced unemployment benefits with few options. There's 10 million unfilled jobs in America.
There are more jobs available than people without jobs right now. And then just empirically speaking, walking around, I see people, you know, job signs everywhere, we'll offer you bonuses, et cetera, et cetera. Now, listen, there are some people who can't work because through no fault of their own. But clearly, these extra benefits have dissuaded people and disincentivized people from working. I mean, it's just common sense. You know, they'll pull out some economist who tells you no. Same economists who are 750,000 jobs off on the last report, you know, in their forecasting. I mean, listen, these days you can find an economist to tell you anything you want. But we'll see now. I mean, now that they've run out and not a single state has taken up the administration on expanding it, we'll see what happens.
I wanted to get
to, I'm sorry to interrupt you. One quick thing.
Go ahead.
And why is it so politically incorrect to say, go get a job these days?
I know.
I know.
How dare you?
Everyone attacks me like it's a crazy thing to say. Well, you have a job. That's right. I mean, I go to my job. I know, you know, I mean, you know, I don't always have this job. I mean, people work and sometimes it's not the job they want and they have to work themselves. We're creating this dependency, not just, you know, on the ground, but this idea that government always has to be there to make sure you have the job you want. I mean, that's just insane. It's not how the real world works.
Well, you can also still work at home. There's jobs that are offering that, and people are just choosing not to. They're staying in their house because they don't want to leave.
Right, and guess what? Some people are just lazy, and I'm not above that, right? I mean, if you gave me an easy way out, maybe I'd take it. I mean, but we're not allowed to.
I don't think you would.
We're not allowed to say these sorts of things anymore, right?
It's racist.
Speaking of government being there, how about government not being there, like in Afghanistan, when their job is to make sure that Americans are evacuated, and you have stories that are undermining the administration's narrative, not just about the number of Americans that are still stranded there, if I can use that word, stranded, as well as the competing stories about Taliban not allowing flights with Americans to take off, or our own State Department not allowing private rescue flights to take off for some reason. I mean, just your sort of perspective on where we're at after America's withdrawal, with zero Americans being evacuated since the withdrawal.
I try not to be too dramatic about things, but I think this is just one of the great scandals of the last maybe decade, right? You know, we left Americans behind, and has nothing to do with the idea itself to withdraw. We left Americans behind because we didn't withdraw in any sort of competent way. And that's on the president and no one else. And we left Americans in a place run by an Islamic militia that's taken over the whole country. And I just, in any other, you know, if this, I hate even formulating it this way, but if this was the Trump presidency, this would be the biggest story of the decade. And yet we're already turning the page. It's a failure of the government. It's a failure of our armed forces, not the people on the ground, but the generals and the leaders. And it's a failure of the media. We don't even know what's going on. They just regurgitate whatever numbers they're giving, 200, whatever, you know, left, et cetera. That's what Biden tells them. And we don't know the truth. And no one really seems that interested in getting to it, not in the establishment media.
And something else that would be a story splashed across the headlines, dominating the news talk channels. This story of the Biden administration losing about 5,000 migrant children They don't seem to know where they're at. Axios reporting, Department of Health and Human Services has lost contact with more than 4,500 children who crossed the border illegally after it released them into the country. And so, you know, again, both the competence as well as the compassion. Competent, they're compassionate, and they turn out to be neither.
The government's job, the executive branch, it has a few jobs. One is foreign policy, so, you know, running the withdrawal from Afghanistan without leaving Americans there to be hostages. And the other is to control the border. And the things they're supposed to do, they fail, you know, in every way imaginable. And the things that they're not supposed to do, like tell you what, you know, what your landlord agreement's like, they want to get involved in. Everything that the liberal media was all hyped up about and AOC was crying about at the border is happening now. It's been happening for a year. And they don't seem to care anymore. I mean, it's a scandal. You know, I mean, one thing, the executive branch is supposed to be running the bureaucracy and they can't even do that right. And yet they're busy with all kinds of issues that are none of their business, and they can't do a good job in the issue that matters, like controlling the border and not allowing children just to disappear. You know, they have no health care, you know, just as on a humanitarian level, not even talking about just, you know, this open border stuff. I mean, these are kids. It's not their fault. And the Biden administration failed them in a way that is far worse than what the Trump administration was doing and that everyone got so angry about.
He is David Harsanyi, senior writer for National Review. The book, First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun, From the Revolution to Today. David, thanks as always.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.